The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
In this episode, as we continue to study Oswald's time in New Orleans, we turn the spotlight away from Lee Harvey Oswald and focus instead on an enigmatic man who many people believe was at the heart of the Kennedy assassination, David Ferry.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. David Ferry was born in Cleveland, Ohio. He went to high school at the prestigious private Catholic institution, St. Ignatius. After he graduated, Ferry studied to become a priest at Baldwin Wallace College and then St. Charles Seminary in Carthagena, Ohio. After Ferry had studied for 6 years in preparation to be a priest, St. Charles refused to allow him to continue his studies because Ferry couldn't get along with people and he didn't like being told what to do. Ferry then returned to Cleveland to teach English and aeronautics at Benedictine High School. While he was studying to be a priest, Ferry had learned how to fly airplanes. He put those skills to use when he got involved with the Civil Air Patrol, or the CAP. This is also the time when Ferry's interest in fighting communists began to emerge. Ferry even tried to secure an Air Force commission so that he could train pilots by writing to President Truman's defense secretary, Lewis Johnson. Ferry said that if he was given permission to train the pilots, quote, "By God, they will get into action and kill those Russians. They should have been wiped out years ago. When am I going to get the commission? When the Russians are bombing Cleveland?" In 1948, Ferry flew a grounded plane from Columbus to Cleveland with no lights. When he landed, he said that he was an officer in the Air Force. Then, in 1950, two CAP cadets reported that Ferry, as their instructor, took them to a brothel. Ferry was able to avoid being kicked out of the CAP altogether and negotiated being transferred to the Louisiana branch. And when the Louisiana CAP contacted the Ohio CAP for Ferry's record, it was missing. Ferry moved to New Orleans in 1951, where he got a job as a pilot with Eastern Airlines. Ferry also continued his work with the Civil Air Patrol. He served as an instructor and later a commander. But in 1954, a CAP cadet from Ferry's group had a fatal crash, which led to Ferry being demoted to the role of guest instructor. It was during this time in the summer of 1955 that David Ferry knew and instructed Lee Harvey Oswald in the Civil Air Patrol. As we discussed in depth in episode 30, the question of whether or not Oswald and Ferry knew one another was once disputed, but it no longer is. We know with certainty that David Ferry was Oswald's instructor when Oswald was in the Civil Air Patrol from June until September of 1955. There are at least six witnesses who support this proposition, and more importantly, a photograph showing Oswald and Ferry together at a cookout. When Ferry was asked by the New Orleans police, the FBI, and the Secret Service if he knew Oswald, he denied knowing him or even, quote, ever seeing him before. Sometime in the mid-1950s, David Ferry began to suffer from an increasingly advanced form of alopecia, which led to him having complete hair loss. He would sometimes wear crude wigs and exaggerated fake eyebrows, which made him tend to stick out in a crowd. In 1961, apparently in a drunken attempt to try to impress one of his cadets, Ferry stole an airplane and went for a joyride, buzzing treetops along the way. When Ferry landed, the FAA was waiting for him. As a result, he was expelled from the cap and eventually lost his job at Eastern Airlines. Ferry's drunken joyride wasn't the only problem he had. According to the HSCA, around August of 1961, quote, Ferry gained entrance to the New Orleans Detention Center to visit a runaway boy by saying that he was a doctor. The parents of another boy complained that their son was staying with Ferry, which resulted in Ferry being charged for contributing to the delinquency of a juvenile and for crimes against nature on a 15-year-old boy and indecent exposure with three others. Ferry was suspended without pay from Eastern Airlines on August 26th of 1961. He retained attorney G. Ray Gill, who was well known as the lawyer for Carlos Marcello, to help him out with the charges against him. Gill allowed Ferry to do investigative work for his law firm instead of paying the legal fee. Ferry made that same deal with Guy Bannister, who provided investigation services for Ferry's case in exchange for Ferry working for him. After August of 1961, David Ferry still didn't have gainful employment, and he was trying to get his job back at Eastern Airlines. Ferry ultimately lost his grievance with Eastern Airlines on September 30th of 1963. According to the HSCA, by early 1961, Ferry and one of his former CAP cadets, Leighton Martins, were working with anti-Castro Cuban exile Sergio Arcacha Smith. Ferry then, quote, became Smith's eager partner in counter-revolutionary activities. He reportedly built two miniature submarines, which he planned to use for an attack on Havana Harbor, obtained several rifles and mortars for the proposed invasion, and was reportedly teaching Cubans how to fly. Further, several of Ferry's cadets claimed to have taken trips to Cuba in Ferry's airplane. When Ferry was still employed by Eastern Airlines, the de facto leader of the Cuban exiles in New Orleans, Sergio Arcacha Smith, wrote a letter to the president of the company on behalf of Ferry. Arcacha Smith requested that Eastern Airlines pay Ferry for 60 to 90 days of leave so that he could go and help the anti-Castro Cubans. And while the company denied Arcacha Smith's request, David Ferry's vacation time in April of 1961 was at the same time as the Bay of Pigs invasion. Ferry was reportedly at Arcacha Smith's house when the invasion happened. As we discussed in episode 47, Ferry was also involved in the Schlumberger raid in Houma, Louisiana in 1961. As you may recall, munitions were stolen from Schlumberger and apparently brought to Guy Bannister's office. That raid also involved Sergio Arcacha Smith. Another participant in the Homer raid, Gordon Novel, said that David Ferry trained Cubans near New Orleans at Abita Springs and at the Belle Chasse Naval Station. Ferry told his former Cap cadet John Erian that the equipment for training these Cubans was coming from the State Department and the CIA through Sergio Arcacha Smith. Guy Bannister's secretary, Delphine Roberts, said that Ferry took Oswald to one of these Cuban exile training camps. INS agent Wendell Roche said that there were films of one of these Cuban exile training camps. And Bob Tannenbaum, the deputy counsel of the HSCA, who would go on to be the mayor of Beverly Hills, remembers watching one of these films. Tannenbaum brought in witnesses to try to help identify the people on the film. He said that David Phillips, Guy Bannister, and Lee Harvey Oswald were all identified by witnesses who knew their faces as being on that film. Tannenbaum's observations were confirmed by HSCA investigator L.J. Delsa and photo analyst Robert Groden. This film of the Cuban exile training camp, which allegedly shows Oswald, has since disappeared. Cuban exile Ricardo Morales, also known as Monkey, was an anti-Castro CIA contract agent and FBI informant. He served as a sniper instructor at the CIA-sponsored Cuban exile training camps. In 2021, Morales' son, Ricardo Morales Jr., came forward to share what his father, who had passed away in 1982, told him, which is that he had worked with Lee Harvey Oswald at one of the Cuban exile training camps.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger, and you can get started now by saving when you join today. We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need, and you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you. Most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save. Just $1 down, $15 a month. See Home Club for details.
We know that in the summer of 1963, David Ferry was in close contact with Guy Bannister and Sergio Arcacha Smith. Given Bannister's intelligence ties and Arcacha Smith's direct relationship with the CIA, if Ferry wasn't officially recognized CIA personnel, at a minimum, he was surrounded by people who had clear intelligence ties. But there is some evidence to support Ferry being linked to the agency. In early 1958, CIA officer Donald Norton picked up $150,000 in cash in the Atlanta airport, and then he brought it to Carlo Media, a Cuban TV star who was working with the CIA against the Batista regime. The person Norton got the cash from in Atlanta, whom his CIA handler had told him to meet, was named Hugh Ferris. Norton met Ferris again a second time and noticed that he was wearing a very sloppy wig. In 1960, while he was in New Orleans, Norton stopped at the Mayo Mai Club and saw the man who he knew as Hugh Ferris in Atlanta, the same man who had given him the package of money for Cuba. That man was David Ferry. Ferry told Al Landry, one of his former Civil Air Patrol cadets, that he was working for the CIA. Carl McNabb, a former CIA pilot, also said that he met Ferry when both men were flying missions for the CIA. In addition to these witness statements that Ferry worked on behalf of the CIA, there's also support for the idea that Ferry was engaged in activity that is far from normal for a pilot. For example, according to a December 12, 1963 FAA report about David Ferry, he was under investigation by U.S. Customs for possible gun-running activities in the fall of 1959. And in September of 1961, the U.S. Border Patrol received information that Ferry was attempting to purchase a C-47 airplane and reportedly had a cache of arms in the New Orleans area. So David Ferry wasn't just a big talker. There are receipts that show that he was a man in the arena. Now, we don't know exactly what he was doing, but it's pretty clear that he wasn't just a commercial pilot. According to author and national security archivist Peter Kornbluh, David Ferry became a contract agent for the CIA and flew missions over Cuba, including where he actually bombed targets inside of Cuba. Another one of Ferry's CAP cadets, Robert Boylston, told the HSCA that Ferry said he was wounded in 1961 when he was on a flight over Cuba. But on the other hand, the HSCA determined that there was no evidence that Ferry was connected with the U.S. government, and that Ferry's assistance and interest in anti-communist matters appeared to be voluntary. In the fall of 1963, Ferry worked as an investigator on a case with G. Ray Gill that was on behalf of mafia boss Carlos Marcello. The case, which Marcello ultimately beat, was about a fraudulent birth certificate. According to the HSCA, Ferry started working for Marcello as early as the spring of 1961, and there's an unconfirmed Border Patrol report from February of 1962 that says Ferry was the pilot who flew Carlos Marcello back to the United States from Guatemala after he had been deported by Attorney General Robert Kennedy. An April 1961 FBI report says that Marcello offered Sergio Arcacha Smith a deal whereby Marcello would make a substantial donation to the anti-Castro movement in exchange for concessions with Cuba after Castro was overthrown. According to Cuban exile Carlos Quiroga, Ferry always had $100 bills and would frequently give money to Arcacha Smith. This was during a period of time when Ferry had no known income after being suspended from Eastern Airlines. It's established that David Ferry knew Oswald from the Civil Air Patrol for a period of about 3 months in the summer of 1955. But the real question when it comes to Ferry and Oswald is whether they knew one another in the summer of 1963. We talked about Delphine Roberts' claim that Oswald went with Ferry to Cuban exile training camps near New Orleans. We also mentioned the film that was seen by Bob Tannenbaum and confirmed by Robert Grodin and L.J. Delsa, where Oswald is allegedly seen participating in one of these Cuban exile training camps. There's also the claim by Ricardo Morales's son that Morales trained Oswald at one of these Cuban exile camps. We also heard from Bannister investigator Jack Martin that he saw Oswald with David Ferry in Bannister's office in the summer of 1963. But there are a few more people who claim to have seen Oswald with David Ferry. In late June or early July of 1963, Van Burns worked in a booth at Pontchartrain Beach Amusement Park in New Orleans. One night, a friend of Burns introduced him to two men, Lee Oswald and David Ferry. Burns' friend said that he had flown with Ferry over the Gulf of Mexico and that Ferry had been involved in several missions to Cuba. In September of 1963, New Orleans resident George Wilcox saw David Ferry, Lee Harvey Oswald, and numerous Cubans dressed in military fatigues near Bedico Creek, about 50 miles north of New Orleans. According to Wilcox, it looked like they were doing military training maneuvers. After President Kennedy was assassinated, David Ferry was apparently concerned about something having to do with a library card and Lee Harvey Oswald. According to Leighton Martins, attorney G. Ray Gill had, quote, come to relay a message to Ferry that his library card was found among Oswald's effects. It appears that David Ferry may have had reason to believe that Oswald had his library card. According to the HSCA, quote, Oswald's former landlady in New Orleans, Mrs. Jessie Garner, told the committee that she recalled that Ferry visited her home on the night of the assassination and asked about Oswald's library card. Mrs. Garner would not talk to Ferry. Garner was called to testify at the Clay Shaw trial. She was shown a photo of David Ferry and identified him as the man who had come to visit her. But she wasn't asked about any details regarding why Ferry had visited. And it's not just Garner who said that David Ferry came around looking for a library card. Oswald's neighbor, Doris Eames, told Jim Garrison's office in 1968 that, quote, Ferry had come by her house after the assassination inquiring if her husband had any information regarding Oswald's library card. Her husband told Ferry he had seen Oswald in the public library, but had no information about the library card Oswald used. In addition to contacting Oswald's landlord and his neighbor regarding Oswald's library card, Ferry also reached out to Roy McCoy, one of his former cadets in the Civil Air Patrol. Ferry wanted to see if McCoy had any photographs that showed Oswald and Ferry together. If these allegations from Garner, Eames, and McCoy are true, it shows that Ferry, at a minimum, knew Oswald in the summer of 1963. It also makes it look like Ferry's worried about being associated with Oswald, and he has something to hide. In summary, there is plenty of evidence to support the idea that Oswald and Ferry did know one another in the summer of 1963. Given all the other evidence that we've covered about Oswald being affiliated with Guy Bannister's office, it would make sense for Oswald to interact with Ferry as well, especially if he already had a pre-existing relationship with him from when Ferry was Oswald's cap instructor. To believe that David Ferry had no association with Oswald at all in the summer of 1963, you'd have to dismiss what was said by these 10 people: Delphine Roberts, Jack Martin, Bob Tannenbaum, Robert Groden, L.J. Delsa, Ricardo Morales Jr., Van Burns, George Wilcox, Jessie Garner, and Doris Eames. We don't have the details of what Oswald and Ferry were up to when they were together, but in my view, Oswald and Ferry most likely interacted with some of the same people and saw one another on multiple occasions in the summer of 1963. Next time on Solving JFK, we summarize and cover the high points of Jim Garrison's trial against Clay Shaw as we wrap up the final episode of our series on Oswald in New Orleans. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger, and you can get started now by saving when you join today. We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need, and you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you, most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save. Just $1 down, $15 a month. See Home Club for details.